The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, welcome. Sorry, I always yell into a mic. I can't help it. Okay, before introduction, I just have to say this book is awesome. I totally love it. Yeah, it's fantastic. And then, now, formal introduction. So, we're all very lucky to be here tonight with one of the world's preeminent photographers, Sally Mann, who's here this evening to read from her new memoir and to discuss the fantastic new memoir, Hold Still, A Memoir with Photographs. I could go on for a long time listing Ms. Mann's accolades, but for brevity's sake, I think I can condense it to Sally Mann is one of the most important American photographers working today. So there you go. I read the book twice in just preparation for this one-second introduction. And one of the things is I couldn't help but think that the title Hold Still is a little bit of a misnomer, because the book moves, I don't know if you've met it, it moves in this kind of unbelievable way. I thought like a river, sometimes like the Blackwater River in Virginia, that's very slow. It's deep and slow moving, and it's clear and dark. And then sometimes it's like the Niagara River, where you're just kind of putting along, and then all of a sudden you're going over with no barrel. You're like, what the hell? So it's pretty fantastic. There are a lot of things that I had to just edit out because I can't just keep talking about the book. But I will say there was one portion where Ms. Mann asks a rhetorical question in response to an idiotic note with the misguided belief that two-dimensional visual representations of a person can somehow truly describe the essence of that person. And Ms. Mann's response was, how can a sentient person of the modern age mistake photography for reality? All perception is selection, and all photographs, no matter how objectively journalistic the photographer's intent, exclude the aspects of the moment's complexity. Photographs economize the truth. Thank you. There are always moments more or less illusory, abducted from time's continuum. That portion just kills me. She just nails it with that. Through a series of images, Ms. Mann clearly articulates the enormous amount of work that goes into making a photo. The series of photos that she presents, both in text and in image, describe it. One of the things that's amazing to me in the book is the collection of personal notes that have been saved for any period of time and photographs that run the gamut of how one might identify or describe a photograph, from germinal fine art photographs to family snapshots. And the idea that they can be read in more than one way is really fascinating to me. I just also need to recognize one of my favorite notes in it, her mother's note, a passive-aggressive note, greetings of the season, which was, oh, these were too tall for my shelves. Happy holidays, and much, much more. It's fantastic. There's also a passage where Ms. Mann writes about family pictures and describes her genesis as simple exploration, at times of a documentary nature, at others conceptual or aesthetic, and in the best pictures, all at once. And like the best pictures described in that, Hold Still is all at once. There's a ending of a William Carlos Williams poem that's from Spring and All. It's by the road to the contagious hospital. And the last few lines are, lifeless in appearance, sluggish, day's spring approaches. They enter the new world naked, cold, uncertain of all save that they enter. All about them, the cold, familiar wind. And that's really what I felt the memoir was about. It was about everything, beautiful and terrible simultaneously. And so, without further ado, I would like to introduce Sally Mann. Truly my honor. No, I wanted to do it up.
Hi, guys. None of this Ms. Mann stuff. I mean,
sorry, really. Because I'm very formal.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you are. Clearly, look at you. We're going to do a little reading from the book that Nicole and I just sort of cobbled together. So it jumps around in time a little bit, but it starts at chapter 3. And I've got some pictures to go with it, but chapter 3. And maybe we should lower the lights. Oh, wait, are there lights at this podium? I forgot to ask that. Okay, good. Well, then I'm going to start. Okay, chapter 3, The Bending Arc. As many people have remarked, I am lucky to have found Larry Mann when I did. Whether I was born this way or my personality was formed by circumstance, I don't think anyone would call me an easy person to deal with. And by the time our paths crossed, the hormones of the teen years had only made things worse. I had been a near feral child, raised not by wolves, but by the 12 boxer dogs my father kept around Boxerwood, the honeysuckle strangled and darkly mysterious 30-acre property where I grew up. The story of my intractability has been told and retold to me all my life by my elders, usually accompanied by a friendly little cheek pinch and a sympathetic glance over at my mother. Recently, in tracking down stories about Virginia Carter, the black woman who worked for my family for nearly 50 years, I visited Jane Alexander, a 96-year-old, who repeated to me, in a soft voice with a bobby pin twang to it, the now familiar tale of my refusal to wear a stitch of clothing until I was 5. Family snapshots seem to bear this out. I know that my mother tried to raise me properly, but I made her cross as 2 sticks, so she turned the day-to-day care of her stroppy, unruly child over to Virginia, known to everyone as Gigi, a name given her by my eldest brother, Bob. Jane Alexander reminded me about the beautiful, often handmade dresses that Gigi would lovingly press for me in hopes that they would soften my resolve to live as a dog. I have them still, pristine and barely worn. If my early years sound a bit like those legends of wolf teat sucklers, I guess they were. But all the same, when I compare the lives of children today, monitored, protected, medicated, and overscheduled, to my own unsupervised, dirty, boring childhood, I believe I had the better deal. I grew into the person I am today, for better or worse, on those lifeless summer afternoons, having doggy adventures that took me far from home, where no one had looked for me or missed me in the least. Looking back, though, it could be that my parents were a bit on the less than diligent side, even for the times. Once, when I was with my mother in the dry goods section of Leggett's department store, we saw the distinctive going-to-town hat worn by Mrs. Hinton bobbing above the bolts of cloth. She was the mother of my brother Bob's best friend, Billy Hinton. When she saw my mother, she brightened and said, "Oh, Billy just received a postcard from Bob. Apparently he loves his new school." My mother, rubbing some velveteen between forefinger and thumb, responded distractedly, "Oh, that's good. We hoped he'd gotten there okay." Turns out that 10 days before, my parents had packed a steamer trunk full of warm clothes for my 15-year-old brother and driven him to the Lynchburg, Virginia train station. After 8 hours on the Lynchburg train, he had to change stations in New York. My parents told him to carry his trunk from Penn Station to Grand Central and to locate the overnight train to a town near the Putney School, the Vermont boarding school he was to attend. Then they left him and apparently never wondered if those connections had worked for the boy, who had not traveled alone before, or even if he had made it to Putney at all. They had heard nothing since dropping him off, and had never called the school to check. My mother told that story countless times, laughing gaily at her recollection of Mrs. Hinton's shock. The assumption back then in the palmy post-war Eisenhower years in America was that everything was fine now, and that was true for the most part. I think my parents were fairly untroubled by child-rearing issues, except for the constant battles over clothing their stubborn hoyden. My father called me Jaybird because I was that naked. But eventually, even that was solved by the arrival in 1956 of Mr. Coffey's carpentry crew, there to build a cottage for my grandmother Jessie on the property. My mother proposed a deal. If I wanted to hang out with the carpenters, I had to wear clothes of some sort. I was so lonely, I took it. Even though I finally agreed to wear clothing, I had some difficulty working out the details, as my mother's exasperated journal entries report. Sally is in a towering rage in her room because I won't let her go to play school with tattered and dirty underpants instead of the clean ones. Her turn to create a ruckus. I'm firm and calm at present, but I'm about to blow up myself. Despite being kicked out several times for not wearing any underwear, never mind tattered and dirty, a few mornings a week I began to attend Mrs. Lackman's school, where I worked on my socialization skills. By springtime, I had managed to make some human friends whose parents drove them out to my house for a birthday party presided over by Gigi. By the time I began real school, I was almost normal. I no longer spent my days poking at snapping turtles in the pond or hiding out with my grubby blanket in my honeysuckle caves or following my unneutered beagle on his amorous adventures down the paved road from which, when I was hungry, I would pull stringy hot tar to chew like gum. I now wore crinolines, little white socks, and gauzy dresses. So there's a little gap here. I go from there to high school. On the weekends, I would head off with my date in his Chevelle or El Camino, my hair rat's-nested and lacquered into ringlets atop my heavily made-up face, eyelashes curled and matted with mascara, heavy black lines drawn across and well past my eyelid in a Cher-like Cleopatra imitation, lips shiny with cheap lipstick, jungle gardenia flowering at my throat, on my wrists, and between my A-cup breasts, which did their best to swell out of a padded bra. I would generally heave in pretty close to my absolute curfew so as not to enrage my punctilious father unduly and find my parents serenely sitting on the couch in the living room. My mother, with her stockinged legs tucked beneath her, would be wreathed in blue cigarette smoke, deep in the New York Times or Harper's. My father, a well-sharpened yellow pencil in hand, would be reading with pointy intensity some scholarly paper or plant catalog from the Far East and wouldn't deign to raise his eyes. Stripping off her reading glasses, my mother would squint through the smoke at me with vague confusion, as though an unexpected stranger had just appeared. Weaving slightly, I would stand not in front of them but off to the side, as if eager to head down the hall to my bedroom to get some last-minute studying done. My hair, trailing bobby pins, would be matted and tendrilled against my hickey-spotted neck, and the skirt of my dress would be wrinkled, the taupe toes of pantyhose peeking out from my purse. My swollen lips were now a natural, chapped red, and my cheeks blushed with beard burn. Peering over the angry marks on either side of her nose left by her glasses, my mother, studying the stone fireplace 4 feet behind me, would ask casually, "Oh, did you have a nice time, dear?" Really, what choice did they have but to send me away to school? My brothers, 9 and 7 years older than me, were hectoring them to send me to Putney, which they'd both attended and loved. Even I knew, on some level, that I needed to get out of the high school world whose horizon stopped at cheerleader tryouts and drag races on the bypass. Ray Goodlatte, the admissions director at Putney, must have waived a few of their policies to get me in. In a pattern that has remained constant all my life, my verbal scores were in the 99th percentile, but, oh God, were my math scores abysmal. And my high school grades were only so-so, not always on the honor roll anymore. Most of the kids at Putney were sophisticated children of urban intellectuals with good scores and good grades, fewer than 20% from below the Mason-Dixon line. Not one would have known, as I did, what a whomping a four-on-the-floor GTO could give a barracuda in the quarter mile on the bypass. So in September of 1967, my mother packed me and my brass-cornered trunk, the same one that my brother Bob had lugged from station to station in New York, into her powder-blue Rambler station wagon, and we set off for Vermont. Halfway there, the car blew a head gasket and died, so we rented a much newer car. In it, as we pulled up to White Cottage, my new dorm, I unknowingly enjoyed the last moment of personal confidence that I was to feel for a long time. The first week, I raised my hand in Hepper Caldwell's history class and asked what a Jew was. Hepper, we were allowed to call our teachers by their first names, though startled, refrained from making fun of me, but no such luck from the rest of the class, many of whom were Jews. I was the most ridiculed minority of all, a dumb cracker with a trunk full of very uncool, reversible wraparound skirts my mother had sewn herself, Clark's desert boots with crepe soles from Talbot's, and variably sized pink foam hair rollers. Nobody at Putney had hydrogen peroxide blonde hair teased into a beehive. Nobody at Putney wore makeup, and nobody at Putney listened to the Righteous Brothers or wore her boyfriend's letter sweater and heavy class ring, its band wrapped with dirty adhesive tape. Okay, so we're moving ahead just a bit, maybe 3 or 4 years, chapter 4, The Family of Man. After Putney and a wayward summer writing poetry and taking pictures in Mexico, I enrolled at Bennington College, figuring it would be pretty much the same as Putney, 48 miles away. I wasn't any fonder of being way up north, but it was a known quantity, as opposed to Sarah Lawrence or Barnard, schools that I decided were too urban for me. Flying the familiar route on Piedmont Airlines to tiny Weir's Cave Airport, I arrived home for Christmas in 1969 and finally met Larry 3 months after our destiny, unbeknownst to us, had been sealed on the afternoon he moved the epic stone. You'll have to read the book to know what that's about. The farmhouse where my Lexington boyfriend lived had an odd layout, and one night as I slouched in a satanically bad mood on the edge of his bed, Larry walked through the room to the shared bathroom. I had no idea who he was. He did not so much as glance in my direction, but my eyes followed him with a warm, glittering interest. We were married 6 months later. We skip ahead a bit. You'd never know it by looking at the parents' allocation of resources and time, but there were two sons in the Mann family, Larry and Chad, 2 years younger. The Manns had chosen to concentrate their efforts on Larry, probably because of his exceptional good looks, tractability, and general social ease. Directly inside the front door of their home was a large, gilt-frame, Ancien Régime, painting of Larry the Equestrian, executed in the fawning style of an Ancien Régime court artist. Nowhere in the house was there any sign that there was another child in the family. No pictures or trophies or framed diplomas. Chad also came in for physical abuse by his mother, but he surmises that because he wore glasses, he didn't get the hard facial slaps that sent Larry to school with his ears ringing and reddened, and instead got just the spoon and the brush. Except for the beatings, Chad was basically ignored, which in a way was a blessing. The Manns zeroed in on the horse world as the best place to show off their handsome son and to make contacts with the right kind of people. Every afternoon after school, Larry was picked up by his mother in a Mustang convertible, her bouffant covered by an Hermes scarf, and driven to Oxridge Hunt Club for intensive lessons in dressage and jumping by their top instructors. In fact, he loved horses and riding, even ring work in the fancy horse shows. Like me, he found time on a horse transcendent and healing in some way, but especially in the less structured disciplines, playing polo, fox hunting, or occasionally just galloping on the cinder paths that lined the fields. While his mother drank martinis at the club bar, Larry hung out with the forbidden groom underclass and realized all the more clearly the trap into which he had been born. But even into his late teens, he remained pliant, escorting the daughters of the rich to balls at the Ritz, while with the avidity of a Spanish conqueror sinking Inca gold, his mother scoured the hunt clubs and society pages for just the right wealthy daughter-in-law. The girl Larry brought home in spring 1970 was far from meeting any of their criteria. "She goes to Bennington?" they asked incredulously, responding to the news of our romance as if he had found me in a leper colony outside Baton Rouge. Implacably, Larry said yes. Bending to his unexpected defiance, they offered a grudging invitation for me to visit. When Larry and I arrived over Easter, his mother placed a Lilly Pulitzer outfit on the bed in my room as an alternative to my 501s and Fry boots. I decided right there that she was a ring-tailed yard bitch. The feeling was clearly mutual. At the midday Easter dinner, when we announced we were going to get married in 6 weeks, his parents and grandparents burst into tears and left the table. We looked over at Chad, who raised an eyebrow and smiled, then, spooning mint jelly onto his plate, continued eating. We did the same, and that night, Larry crossed from his bedroom to mine, and we made noisy love before leaving at dawn. We found out later that after that week, his parents made an appointment with their lawyer to cut Larry out of their will. Their disapproval only increased our determination and the perverse pleasure we took in our unacceptable love. The preparations for the wedding were easy. We bought two simple gold rings at Ed Levin's shop in Bennington, and I designed a demure cotton dress that I had a local seamstress stitch up. My father dusted off his Linhof and shot a few pictures, one of which Larry's parents grudgingly put in the New Canaan newspaper. So now we skip ahead a few years. I had a vision of how I wanted to live. In 1969, my parents and I had visited Helen and Scott Nearing on their subsistence farm in Maine, and I had made a heavily underscored mental note that this was exactly what I wanted for myself. A life of simplicity, pluck, seclusion, and soul-satisfying, ecological, sweat-of-the-brow will vote with our lives' self-sufficiency. 7 years later, Larry and I were giving it a go. By 1977, we were digging by hand the footers for an impossibly perilous cliff dwelling. And then for the next half decade, we scavenged building materials for it, learning as we went. By the time Cy, and this is Cy Twombly, who also lived in Lexington and was a friend, by the time Cy moved back to Lexington in 1993, the resultant, spindly, hand-built, Rube Goldberg-like, passive solar house had bulked up with a succession of shed-roofed add-ons, living areas cantilevered out over the abyss and labyrinthine porches covered with vines. A commercial pilot we know once remarked that from the air, our house resembled those shanty towns on the edge of the Mexico City dump, and we were not offended. It was a totally cool Big Sur-ish house, impractical, whimsical, not to code in any respect, the kind of place that stopped passersby in their tracks and lured them, cautious and curious, past the basilisk sculptures to our slabwood front door. Cy, too, would wander down from the warehouse to that door, calling out in his distinctive, hesitant voice, "Sally, are you receiving?" We both liked to sit out on the wisteria-covered back deck, overlooking the creek, especially on those sultry summer nights when the fog rose from the bottomland and wisped among the racemes of white bloom. One such night found a group of us with Cy and Nicola, his gentle, erudite companion, sitting after a late dinner on that porch, the newspaper-covered table nacreous with oyster shells, bottles of wine darkening the center. I mentioned my past fascination with Ezra Pound, an American who, like Cy, had found Italy his place for, quote, starting things, and about whom I had written my master's thesis. At this, Cy, sitting to my right at the head of the table, leaned over to me with a look of a confidence about to be divulged, so I pressed close. When Cy was about to tell a story or make a naughty quip, he would cover his mouth in a schoolchild's way, fingertips lightly touching his primly pursed lips, while above them the eyes were alight and impish. I watched memory veil those eyes as he spoke of a time in the late 1960s when he and Nicola had been invited to the Spoleto Festival by its founder, Giancarlo Menotti. That evening, a Russian pianist was performing, and Menotti honored Sy and Nicola by seating them in his private balcony in the opera theater. As they took their seats, they were startled to see behind them Ezra Pound and Olga Rudge, one of the three women with whom Pound had simultaneous relationships. Sy described Pound as having an aura, a mystical appearance, and as being somehow set apart from regular people. Nicola wrote me later that Pound, quote, acted extremely shy, like only a northern blonde child could be. He hardly looked at us and in a side way. Telling me of this in the humid summer night, Sy emphasized how rare it was to see the reclusive poet, who seldom appeared in public in those later years. Pound had been driven mad, or perhaps more mad, by his wartime incarceration in Pisa for treason. It was there, locked up like an animal in a 6 by 6.5 foot wire cage, that he began writing on a piece of toilet paper the uneven but brilliant Pisan cantos. Interestingly, housed in the cage next to him was Emmett Till's father, Lewis, until he was hanged for, as Pound put it, murder and rape with trimmings. After Pound began to show clear signs of a mental breakdown, he was shipped from Pisa back to the United States and confined to the bug house at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. A decade after his release in 1958, Pound stopped speaking altogether. Much was made of his self-imposed silence, and it has always been reported that not a single word ever passed his lips once he began it. Except to their amazement, Sy and Nicola heard Pound speak to Olga. They both described it as the whispering of a deeply wounded and suspicious man, but also of a man fading out of this life. Sy said he would have loved to have exchanged just one word with this intransigent, mysterious, wrong-headed, brilliant man. Instead, he and Nicola somehow maintained a posture of intense interest in the music played before them, arching backwards in their seats, hoping to hear the thoughts of a genius. Imagine that on my Peckerwood porch, late in the humid, cloyingly fragrant Virginia night, Sy, in a Pound-like whisper, tells a story I found marvelous in the many improbable threads it wove together. That he had seen, had heard Ezra Pound, the author of the lines written on my father's memorial stone, with whom I held a long fascination, and that within this tale was another of my long-held fascinations, Emmett Till. And of course, that the storyteller was Sy, the local hero, come back to sit in the dung heap turned garden that was our home, the prodigal returning to Lexington.
Thanks.
Let's see. Why don't I just ask you a handful of questions and then we'll continue on to the audience.
Right.
I'd love to hear stories all night, but something a little more procedural perhaps to start. When did you first pick up a camera? What's your first memory of picking up a camera? And what made you pick it up?
I'm not sure I have that memory exactly, but I'm pretty sure it was when I was 17. Roughly that age. It was sort of a cool thing to do at Putney. That's what the cool kids did. They took pictures.
And what did you take pictures of?
Oh, crap. I mean, just landscapes. And I mean, in the book is my first contact sheet, and it's, you know, it's just risible. It's absurd. Should I not touch that, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't touch
okay,
it.
Okay, sorry. I'm just,
it's okay.
I'm just an anxious person. So I'll just sit on my hands like this.
Okay. We can all
sit
on
now
our
I
hands.
Can't talk.
Let's make her comfortable.
If I don't
have
my hands, I can't
hands.
Talk. Okay, so yeah, I don't remember picking it up for the first time, but I had an old Leica that my father had taken around the world in 37, and I started shooting with it.
So that was a gift from him, and did
it was a loan from him, which I then sold for like some, you know, something bad. some drugs or alcohol or travel or something. Yeah, and what I'd give to have that camera. I know.
You didn't use it to buy a view camera.
No, I did. No, no, no.
What made you pursue the view camera?
He gave me the view camera, too.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. He had a 5x7 view camera. That I still have.
Okay.
Yeah, 5x7 Rosewood, just gorgeous little view camera.
But the one you use now is a larger format,
it's 8x10. Yeah. And then I have a bigger one for the Ambro types.
Right. And then the process that you use, I know there are probably a lot of photographers in the audience, but can you talk a bit about the collodion process?
Oh, wet plate?
Yeah, wet plate.
You can't throw a dead cat without hitting a wet plate photographer these days. Anyone who's a photographer in here has probably done wet plate by now. It's become really commonplace. Isn't that right? Isn't that everybody's perception? Everybody's doing wet plate. Yeah. But for the people, for the very few people here who aren't doing wet plate, you take a glass plate and you coat it with I'm so bad with the technical stuff, but you coat it with some kind of material that, to which silver nitrate adheres. And you put it in the silver nitrate, which is the light sensitive stuff that makes the picture, right? And you put it in the silver nitrate and then take the picture while the plate is still wet, hence wet plate. And it gives a really interesting effect, as I'm sure many of you know. It's very prone to serendipitous accident, and that's something that I particularly enjoy about it.
Is that something you came to over time? Was it just in reading the book? It seemed like Michael Miley might have inspired some of those ideas.
Those glass plates. Okay, so... No, we can't ruin the book for them.
Can't, but
yeah, no,
folks,
no,
there are
spoilers,
so many great
here.
Stories, and we have so little time, there's not a chance we can ruin it.
Okay. So when I was, 19 or 20, I was up in the attic at a building at Washington and Lee, which is the university in the town where I live, and I came, opened the door, and there, the whole room, the size of this room practically, maybe not that big. I'm prone to hyperbole, but maybe half this room was filled with glass plates from the 1800s. This photographer who'd been to the Civil War and had come back and chosen to live in Lexington to photograph Robert E. Lee, who had also come back to live in Lexington. And there were just thousands of wet plate negatives. And people were walking on them. Some of them were little bitty ones, and some of them were bigger than 16 by 20, like 20 by 24 glass plates. And so I spent a couple of years just sorting them out, contact printing them, filing them, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and just fell in love with the way they looked. But it was, I don't know, 2 decades before I actually started doing it myself.
But did some of his techniques or some of his aesthetics inspire you in any way?
Well, his technique was 100 times better than mine. So.
Why do you say that?
Why?
Yeah.
Oh, because he knew how to do it.
And but you know how to do it.
Well, yeah, but I don't do it right. I mean, I've never been able to get a perfect plate. I don't know what's wrong with me. But I stopped worrying about it. I think the problem is that when I was making regular silver negatives, like for the at 12 and the family pictures and all that kind of stuff, I wanted them to be perfect. And I had, just spent years trying to make the perfect zone 5 Ansel Adamsy kind of negatives. So that when wet plate came around, I just went, great, no more of that. Just, caution to the winds, let's go. So and that's what the aesthetic really appeals to me for that reason, because it reminds me of my early work when I was like 17, where it didn't matter because I didn't have anything to prove. I was playing. Okay. Yeah, so collodion feels a little like playing to me.
To switch topics a little bit, we're in a library, we're talking about your book. Can you talk about Steichen's Family of Man and the Bork White book and why they were influential and how?
Well, they certainly were. And it's a little embarrassing because people make fun of the Family of Man a lot. I mean, I think there was some even controversy back then that it was too Pollyanna-ish a show and glossed over some of the bigger things. But anyway, that was the book that I had. What you'll read in the book is that I grew up completely by myself. I mean, that whole thing about the 12 dogs being raised by dogs, I really was. I had nothing. I had nobody. We didn't live in where there was any other children. So I had those books. I had The Family Man and a book called You Have Seen Their Faces that were pictures by Dorothea Lange. And they were very powerful and moving. And don't forget, we had, of course you wouldn't know, to forget, but we didn't have television because my father was just such an intellectual snob and he thought television was just so banal and beneath him. And so we had never had television my entire childhood. So all I had was books. And, you know, picture books, yeah, I spent my childhood studying The Family of Man. And the woman I mentioned in there, Virginia, she'd read the captions for me. And I'll never forget watching her. She had these really long fingernails, but they were very coarse and heavy, and so she would read the captions, and one of the captions was, and you'll just, this is what it said, so I'm going to say what it said. It said, I would never let them paste those advertisements on my house like those niggers do. Niggers just don't know how to live, or something like that. So there is Gigi with her finger going under those lines, reading that to me with just the most heartbreaking ache in her voice. It was, imagine, you know, I was just a child and I was trying to figure out what those words meant. It was, anyway, sorry, I'm digressing. But that's, yeah, okay. Those pictures were really powerful. All those pictures were important to me.
Just to switch gears yet again, the book, is, as I mentioned, is just chock full of stories, and there's no way we could deplete all of them from tangents on, not tangents, but bits on Charles Dickens and John Kennedy, and it's amazing the number of people that sort of collided with your life and your forebears' life in some way. But I want to focus just a wee bit on your father, who was so critical to the formation of your sensibility. And if you could talk a bit about how his choice of vocation over avocation affected him and affected the family.
Yeah, my father was a really interesting man. He was smart. He was curious. He was so fond of art. He went to Europe summer after summer. This is when he was maybe 17, 18. He grew up in Dallas, Texas. So he was like a sort of snoot-cocking, you know, rambunctious Dallas boy, gun-shooting, you know, hard-drinking, car-wrecking Dallas kid. But somehow art and culture took hold of him in a really serious way. And by the time he was 17 or 18, he was living for art. His notebooks are just filled with details about, you know, he would go to Florence and there would be pages and pages about the pictures he'd seen and the sculpture, and he loved Donatello, and on and on and on. And at some point and I don't know how this decision was made or made for him, he decided to go to med school, and that's what he did. And he wrote a very, very poignant line. It's in the book. Talking about how the boatman rows in one direction while looking in the other. And it just breaks your heart. You realize what he wanted to be was an artist or a literary figure or a, you know, intellectual figure, anything but not a science figure. And it's that dichotomy that, what's his name?
White? C.P. Snow.
Yeah, C.P. Snow. There we go. White, no, Snow, talks about in his book the two cultures, I think,
yeah.
It is, yeah, how mankind is torn by these two desires, and I think he was, and I think he was an unhappy man as a consequence. He was extremely unavailable emotionally, but a great doctor, you know, yeah.
So how did that aloofness impinge on what you created anyway, or on your art? Did it?
Well, I mean, I suppose every daughter wants to please their father, but I wanted to please my father probably more than most, mm-hmm. because he was so aloof, and I knew he was brilliant. I always thought he was brilliant, and in fact, he was. It's just that he never spoke to me about art. He never spoke to me about culture, the things he loved, or why he loved them, or... He was just a complete cipher to me, and I so wanted to please him. Mm-hmm. And that's not a good position to be in. It's hard to please someone who's that distant.
And your mother? Were you able to please her with your
I didn't care.
Work? You didn't care.
See, that's the one thing that writing this book has done is it's made me realize I sort of over-romanticized my father my whole life and underappreciated my mother. I really just didn't care about her that much. And she was a remarkable woman in her own right, and that's, I think, one of the most painful things about writing this book is the more I learn about her and read her journals, which are just achingly sad, and I feel terrible about my relationship with my mother.
Well, in a way, it could have been worse, right? With all due respect, you could have had Larry's mom.
Although, that's true.
That might have been easier.
Yeah, no, it's true.
She's a tough character.
Oh, yes, she is.
Yeah, those stories are just...
Yeah, we're not going to spoil that one.
Had me invoking the name of the Lord out loud at my kitchen table
surprise.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about your mother's grandfather, his personality seems really congenial to yours. Your mother's father, rather, not her grandfather.
Yeah.
Arthur Evans.
Arthur Evans was a sort of sentimental... sad, nostalgic Welshman, and I try, and maybe it's a little tenuous, but I try and make the relationship between his personality and mine, you know, almost genetically, I suppose, in the book, just because I have just such a broad streak of, I mean, I succumb to the terrible melancholy of nostalgia and romance at the drop of a hat, and I think that came from him.
And a function, too, of being in the South and being so attached
to
the land.
Well, yes, and then, of course, I live
place.
In the South where romance is the currency of the realm. My friend Neil once said that romance is to the Southern artist as snake venom is to the snake handlers of the Appalachians. He said it's a terrible risk, but it's also a ticket to transcendence. And that's exactly how I feel about it.
Well, speaking of transcendence, just looking at the pictures in Deep South, just sort of the gorgeous mythological pictures that you've created, mythological and yet not. I mean, they sort of sometimes go in two directions at once, or we were talking about this earlier.
Yeah.
Is it complementary or contradictory what they're embodying? And I just completely lost my train of thought. Shit.
Oh, pretty good. You were doing fine, though.
I can't remember what I was going to ask you. Deep South mystery. Ah, really seeing. This idea of, I forget what you call it, photography eyes and really seeing.
Oh, putting on your photo eyes.
Putting on your photo eyes and then really seeing. And then you wrote about it in Deep South and you write about it here, this sort of attenuation of the present in the moment when you're given this gift of this picture.
Yeah.
Did I just say everything?
No, you didn't. I mean, I think there, and it happened a little bit when I was writing, too. I think there's this sort of raptus of inspiration that'll come over you. It doesn't happen very often. Like, so many pictures don't come that way. So many pictures just come by plodding, obdurate effort. You just work and work and work and work and take the picture over and over again, or you write the paragraph over and over again. And then there's these moments, and it really is, they are ecstatic, where you get the picture, and it happens almost, I don't know, it's almost mystical. It's almost muse-like.
So then, in the end, is there not much difference between writing well and taking a good picture?
Well, what's interesting about writing this book was harder, was the hardest thing I've ever done, much harder than photography, actually. Mm-hmm. Of course, I mean, there's a great story. Robert Frank was living in an apartment building, and across the courtyard was de Kooning's studio, and he would stand at the window. Robert Frank is a photographer, I'm sure most of you know that. Okay, so de Kooning's a painter. So he would look through his window and see de Kooning pacing back and forth and back and forth in his studio, and he made the observation, which is, you know, obvious, that de Kooning had to man-haul everything right up from his own guts. You know, there was no putting the viewfinder to the face and sorting out the right scene. You know, there was no little string of bubbles that were going to float into the scene, like that great Helen Levitt picture. You know what I'm talking about? Three girls walking along. It's just, you guys know this picture, right? Three girls walking up the street, and someone has blown a bunch of soap bubbles, and they're just sort of trailing along behind these girls. I mean, the photography always offers you the serendipitous. There's always the physical world there. There's always the decisive moment if you seize it. Mm-hmm. But writing isn't like that. I mean, you have to make choices in writing, but you have to create the choices that you have to make, you know, from whole cloth. So it's an entirely, entirely different thing. But yes, I did have a couple of those moments where the words just spilled out of me.
Well, reading the book, I had the impression that it seemed like it came pretty easy, even though you're writing difficult stuff.
Oh, sure it did. 5 years of easy.
Oh my, it's easy and so great to read.
Yeah,
I'm not blowing smoke.
Just open that vein.
Yep. Well, you opened it and channeled it well. I don't know if you want to tell this story. Because for me, it was so remarkable to see the process at work. And it's the story of Emmett getting hit by the Chevelle.
You are a car person, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. He's hit by a car.
Yeah.
And you're there on the road with him, and you think he might not make it. And if you could just talk about that 11 minutes, and then the process that got you to those photographs that you took that sort of helped you through it.
Yeah, so it was a parent's worst nightmare. I was standing on one side of a road, and our son Emmett was on the other, and I put my hand up. He couldn't hear that there was a car coming. The car was going 37 miles an hour. And I put my hand up, but he, you know, it's sort of universal world language for stop, and he was seven. He didn't know. And so he leapt into the road and was hit by this car, and he was just booted, you know, 40-some feet down the road, and was lying in the road, and I rushed to him. Well, actually, I won't make this story too long, but we didn't have cell phones back then, and there were a bunch of construction workers, and no one moved, and I had to run all the way down to the house and make the 911 call. We didn't even have 911 either. I had to call the police department and say my son's been there. I ran back up, and they were still standing there because they thought he was dead, and no one wanted to go, so I went down there and sat with him for the 11 minutes it took for the first aid to come. And I got kind of called on this by someone the other day. I thought about photography while I was sitting there. I thought about whether or not I would have the guts to take a picture. It was a very powerful image, as you might imagine. And there have been people who have been able to take those kind of pictures. There were, you know, I thought about the series that Jim Goldberg did and Richard Avedon did of their fathers, respectively. Both of them fathers, right? Yeah, fathers. And I thought that I just couldn't do it. I didn't have the guts to take that picture. There was no possible way I could have ever thought about taking a picture. I took the view camera into the hospital the next day, and I photographed his pillowcase, and I photographed the matted head, hair, but I've learned that I wasn't a journalist at that moment. But I did also learn that I began a sort of series of pictures that I think of as kind of inoculations against terrible pain, and took photographs of my children almost in staged situations that maybe would prevent the actual ones from ever happening. So it had a sort of an interesting follow-up that way.
And the story continues in the book, and it's remarkable. For those of you like me who are not photographers, you'll get to see how the selection of a print out of a contact sheet, many, many, many photos, results in the right image and just how that all comes together. So for me, that was sort of a little epiphanic. Yeah. It was great. And why don't we take some questions, too? So the way this works is raise your hands. We've got about 15 minutes for questions. Raise your hand. I'll call on you. We will get you a microphone. Who would like to start us off? Yep, right here.
Hi, my name is Lori. I knew this day would come. Cy Twombly introduced me to you. I was a young woman at MoMA and was trapped at a dinner sitting next to him. And he asked me what I was afraid of. And I told him getting old and motherhood. And he said, well, you can't do anything about getting old, so you can't be afraid of that. And he said, but if you want courage, you need to look at Sally Beale.
So I said that?
So I said that.
That's great.
And I didn't know who you were. I didn't collect photography at the time. And I asked Peter Galassi, and Peter Galassi set me down, and I was hooked. So I wanted to tell you that Cy introduced me to you, and I've been a lifelong supporter and fan.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. That's such the nicest thing to hear. Wow.
A question? No, come on, people.
Oh.
Come on, Philly, don't let me down. Yes. All the way in the middle there, way in back.
How's it going? Great talk, by the way. Looking forward to reading the book.
Oh, thank you.
I'm curious, what advice would you give to young photographers nowadays? It seems like your photography resulted from certain life decisions you made. Could you talk about that?
Well, I have to paraphrase two of my favorite people. I'd paraphrase, now I can't think who said it, but someone said, don't wait for inspiration. What was that great quote? I never wait for inspiration because if she came, she'd find me working, something like that. Work hard is the first thing I would say. Work really hard. And I think I'd say, and this is just my personal feeling, and this, but it, I share it with Flaubert, who said that you should live an ordinary, an organized life, but be so that you can be outrageous and original in your art. So, and I think that that has worked for me. I mean, I pretty much stay home and work. That's all I do, and it's a pretty boring, dull life. I don't travel, hardly at all. But I get a lot of work done. So far, it's work hard and work hard, right? And I guess the third thing that I always tell young artists is that if you're working on a project, and that's just me, I work on a project sort of single-mindedly, and that's all I do is that one project. It's just some kind of OCD thing with me. But if you're working on a project and you're thinking about like releasing it out into the world and you know, showing it or publishing it or something, you should always have another project that's sort of in the wings. That's a fairly well along, and a project that you love. I mean, that is calling to you, that is seducing you away from your original project, like a new lover. So I think it's really important not to sink down into that dry well. You know, the well is run dry syndrome, which I'm particularly susceptible to. I don't know about you, but I'm always convinced I'll never take another good picture. But if you've already taken one or two good pictures, or three or four before you finish with a project you think is really good, then at least you have that. You can make that transition. Yeah. So that's worked for me. Mostly the work hard part, though. Yeah.
I could be making this up because my brain, I get confused kind of with things. But as an undergrad, if I remember correctly, one of my professors in our advanced craft class, which was a printing, darkroom printing class,
good,
said that, quoted you, that you said that you weren't necessarily a photographer, but a printer. So first question is that true? And second is, if it is, can you talk about, your prints, I guess, or what?
I must have been in the middle of a big printing project. yeah, because there's sometimes I feel like I'm a factory worker.
But as far as making the print beautiful and what you do to it, not as much as...
Yeah, I mean, craft, we're talking craft here, right? Yeah, craft is really, really important to me. I mean, I want the final print to be gorgeous, and I want to make it myself. It's just some little personality tick that I have. I don't know any other person in the photographic art world, and I these terms are a little bit ambiguous, but who makes their own prints, and who, I mean, I make them, I print them, I flatten them, I spot them, you know, I dry mount them, I put them in the boxes, and I take them to the post office. I do it all myself. It's just, I'm just very committed to the physical product, I guess, and I want it to be, you know, beautiful. I mean, I want the image to be lyrical, and but I also want the actual print to be beautiful too. Yeah, and I like silver prints, just on the subject. Yeah, I'm working now trying to figure out if I can actually do a body of work in digital, and I just don't think I can. Yeah, just not gonna think it's gonna work for me. Yeah.
Why not?
I don't like the paper. Have you seen that paper? It's got a nubbly, you know what I'm talking about? It's got a nubbly kind of feel to it. I mean, but of course, they don't make gorgeous silver paper anymore either. Yeah. I mean, anybody my age who is a printer out there in the audience knows what that Portriga Rapid paper used to look like. My God, that stuff was gorgeous. And you can't make beautiful prints hardly anymore. Mm. So, but I'm just not so crazy about the digital paper.
But does it's
too
it,
specular.
But aside from the paper, I mean, which is obviously a colossal issue, manipulating the image, are you comfortable with that, using the computer, et cetera?
I'm getting that. I mean, I can do that now. Yeah, and it is easier. It's a lot easier. Yeah.
Okay. Hi, good evening. So my question is, what is your position on consent, the consent of your photographic human subject? I'm thinking about this because I feel like, especially today with the internet, a lot of people are very concerned about the ways they are represented and their privacy. So I'm wondering, because you have a lot of human subjects in your photo, in your work, how do you deal with that issue?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about that a lot in the book, because partially in terms of the family pictures, but more just in terms of portraiture in general. I mean, I think it's a very ethically complex thing to make a portrait of a person, a photographic portrait, because the photographer holds all the cards. I mean, you totally control that picture, and you can make a picture of them. And I illustrate this in the book with that famous Steichen picture of that robber baron, whatever his name was.
Morgan.
Yeah, J.P. Morgan. And Steichen was allowed 2 minutes to go in there and take his portrait. And he's sitting there like this in his chair. And Steichen could see that the arm of the chair looked like a dagger. But, of course, Morgan couldn't tell that. He didn't know that. And, of course, Steichen took the picture. And it makes him look like he's about to stab somebody, and that's a perfect example of you know the complexity of portraiture. And actually, I haven't taken any since the family pictures. I haven't until now when I'm working on a project with black men. I haven't taken portraiture for exactly that reason. It is so complex and so freighted, and the question of consent. What I do. And I always did do, even with the 12-year-olds, everybody signed off on those pictures. I would show them the picture, and they signed off on it. And that's still true today. I think it's really, legally it's important, just for the record, but also I think just, you know, in terms of living with yourself. Yeah. It's a good question. And people need to think about that, particularly now when it's so easy to take, you know, everyone's taking pictures all the time, and they don't go away. Yeah.
What became of your father's perception of the person you were growing into as an artist? Did he have a way of taking in your personhood and feeling in a way that through your existence some of his internal contradictions maybe were
resolved? Yeah,
in a
not to put
way.
Words
it's just
in your
a fascinating
mouth. Yeah,
issue
now,
to me.
I think that's sort of how I end that chapter when I talk a little bit about that. I think maybe so. I think he might have somehow realized his thwarted ambitions and desires through, you know, watching me, you know, develop as an artist. He didn't get to see, he didn't live, he died in 88, so I think I'd published at 12, but in his own little, very, very glacial way, he did show me that he was proud of me. Yeah.
Zoe, did you have a question? Yeah, here's the mic. Here's the mic.
Yeah, absolutely. As long as you don't call me Ms. Man.
I know, I'm really proud of it, really proud of it. In the book, there's a number of illustrations, although they seem to actually be part of the language of the book. Children's drawings, notes. I'm wondering, do you have a large collection of ephemera, of pieces of paper like that? And if so, not that it would necessarily figure into your work, but do you find that they have an important weight in your life?
They have a physical weight in my life, that's for sure. There's boxes and boxes of these damn things. Well, you know, someone asked me the other day, in a much less gentle way, if I was actually a hoarder. And so I looked it up, and I thought, you know, maybe, I mean, who else rescues, like, dogs by the gross? I mean, I'll go to the SPCA, and I'll come home with 12 greyhounds. I swear to God, I've done it. You know, who... I remember as a kid, I was watching a friend of mine reach her hand out and snag the chewed up wad of chewing gum that Lady Bird Johnson had left on her, on her ashtray at the Clover Creamery. And I was jealous. I wanted that chewing gum.
I bought it for $45 on eBay. I will sell it to you for $55.
Really? I mean... And I mean, I was telling Ann Patchett this. I've saved every one of my kids' baby teeth, you know, from out from under their pillows. And they're in little envelopes with, you know, like little bloody things hanging out of them. So, yeah, I mean, so I looked it up, and sure enough, it's like, it's an OCD-related disease, and it some of the other things are like high anxiety, yes, check, inability to make decisions, procrastination, perfectionism. I mean, it's just, yeah. So all that ephemera, yeah, you got it too? Yeah, it takes a certain sainted human to put up with us. Well, more power to you.
So yeah. Before we end the evening, there was something in the book that intrigued me, and I wonder if you could fill in the blank. In the acknowledgement, you say there's a supremely entertaining anecdote, which you don't have to tell it.
Legally can't do it.
But what if it doesn't leave this room on on the podcast tonight? Just cut the podcast, and then who knows?
Yeah, I know. No, I'll get my ass kicked if I tell that story. Right, no. I've told it in the past, and I'm afraid I will get my ass kicked. Right,
no ass kicking here.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.